So good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. This is our sixth webinar in the framework of the capacity building program that we ALAC set for the ALS's representatives. So today we have Julie Hammer, who will speak about the security and stability, and she will give you the, she has already a presentation on the Adobe Connect. I will first give the floor to Thierry to give us the usual, rules of housekeeping. So Thierry, please.
Thank you, Tijani. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Pre-Atlas II webinar on the topic of security and stability on Thursday, the 15th of May, 2014 at 1300 UTC. We will not be doing a roll call as it is a webinar, but if I could please remind everyone on the phone bridge as well as the computer to mute your speakers and microphones when not speaking, as well as state your name when speaking, not only for transcription purposes, but also to allow the interpreters to identify you on other language channels. We have Spanish and French interpretation. Thank you, everyone, for joining, and I'll turn it back over to you, Tijani.
Thank you, Jerry. So now Julie Hammer is ready for the webinar. Julie, good morning for you, and please take the floor.
Good evening. Thank you. It's evening here in Australia. Thank you, Tijani.
Okay.
No, not at all. So I would like to present some information about ICANN's role in the security and stability of the DNS, and the outline of the webinar this evening is to define security and stability, and then to define ICANN's role, to gesticulate on why security and stability is important, to talk about the Security and Stability Advisory Committee, the SAC, and just to give one example of a security attack, I think it would be much longer than this webinar to try to cover the whole scope of security and stability, so I thought one example might be useful, and then at the end we'll ask questions. Firstly, ICANN has a limited technical mission, and it is defined in a number of documents, including the Security, Stability and Resiliency Framework. But the second of these technical missions is to preserve and enhance the stability, security and resiliency of the systems that allocate the Internet's unique identifier systems. So there are three other technical missions there. The first one is to coordinate the allocation of the Internet's unique identifier systems. The third one, to maintain and operate the LRoot name server instance as steward for the community. And the final one is to manage ICANN's own internal systems and provide a publicly accessible portal to disseminate and share information. But I will only be covering the second technical mission there tonight. So the definitions of security, stability and resiliency. Security is the capacity to protect and prevent misuse of the Internet unique identifiers. And of course, by the Internet unique identifiers, you all I'm sure know that we're talking about the naming and the numbering system, the DNS names and numbers. The definition of stability is the capacity to ensure that the system operates as expected and that the users of the unique identifiers have confidence that the system operates as expected. And the definition of resiliency is the capacity of the unique identifier system to effectively withstand or tolerate or survive malicious attacks and any other disruptive events without that causing disruption or cessation of service. So ICANN, with its role, there are certain things that ICANN is not. And I think it's important to understand what ICANN is not as well as what ICANN is in this context of security and stability. Firstly, ICANN is not a law enforcement agency. It's not a court of law or any type of government agency in this context. Law enforcement and governments do participate as stakeholders in ICANN's processes and policy development, but ICANN itself does not have any law enforcement responsibilities. ICANN is not responsible for policing the internet or for operationally combating any criminal behaviour. ICANN is not responsible for determining what constitutes illicit conduct on the internet. ICANN is not involved in the use of the internet related to cyber espionage or cyber war. And ICANN is not authorised to unilaterally suspend or terminate domain names. Having said that, ICANN is able to enforce the contracts that it has with third parties, such as registries, including those domain name registration providers. But what ICANN does do is it plays a role in supporting the work of law enforcement or government agencies in carrying out legitimate actions at their request. And those the type of laws that surround that will vary from country to country depending what legal framework the particular is in the particular context. ICANN does participate with the operational security community in studying, analysing and identifying malicious use or abuse of the DNS. And ICANN does play the same part as any other interested stakeholder with regard to internet protocols. But the actual evolution of internet protocols and related standards do not fall within ICANN's remit. They rather reside with more technical organisations such as the Internet Engineering Task Force and the Internet Architecture Board as two examples. So how then does security, stability and resiliency fit into ICANN? And there's quite a number of ways that we can think about that, how that role manifests itself. First of all, we can think of security as one of the core values that ICANN has, and that is actually in accordance with the affirmation of commitment, the agreement that ICANN has with the US Department of Commerce. Secondly, security is one of the four focus areas of ICANN's strategic plan. Security is really an overall theme cutting right across the organisation within ICANN. And indeed, organisationally, it is a department within ICANN. The ICANN has its own security team that looks at security issues both within and outside of ICANN. Security is an essential element in all projects and activities that I can undertake. And finally, security is a key stakeholder group within ICANN, and that is the Security and Stability Advisory Committee. And I guess as part of the introduction, the final thing to just have a quick look at is why is security and stability important? I guess it's pretty obvious to everyone, but to try and think of that in more specific terms, you might like to consider some of these points. First of all, security and stability of the domain name system and of ICANN. Security and stability contributes to the stability of the whole global economic environment. It assists in the prosperity of both developing and developed nations. The internet and the domain name system actually assist nations in the conduct of their business. It supports national security, emergency response and the preservation of law and order. Security and stability facilitates the correct functioning of critical infrastructure all around the world. It enhances opportunities for business and commerce. It enables the free flow of information. And finally, security and stability protects the interests of individual users of the internet. So you can see that it's actually important from one extreme of the individual right through to the other extreme of globally important considerations. So I'd like now just to give you a little bit of information about the SAC, the Security and Stability Advisory Committee, which is one of the other ACs within ICANN, just as ALAC is. The SAC's charter is to advise the ICANN community and the ICANN board on matters relating to the security and integrity of the internet's naming and addressing allocation systems. And the SAC was initiated in 2001, so it's been going for some 12 years now. It began operation in 2002. It provides guidance to the board and to other SOs and ACs, to ICANN staff and to the general community. And as of March this year, there were about 14 members of SAC, all members being appointed for 3-year terms, which can subsequently be renewed. The SAC has a number of activities internally. It has its own membership committee, which manages the interviewing of members to come onto the SAC and the reviewing of their membership on a 3-yearly basis. For ICANN meetings, there is a lot of planning to be done to present DNSSEC workshops and also to prepare for meetings with law enforcement. Each ICANN meeting, the SAC and the law enforcement community meet for several hours and talk about topics of mutual interest. The SAC also has its own annual workshop where it gets together and does a strategic review of its work plan for the following year. And the SAC also has a number of work parties. There's only a capacity to run 3 to 4 work parties at any one point in time. And at the moment, those work parties are one looking at abuse metrics for the identifier system, another one looking at public suffix lists, a work party working as all SOs and ACs are on providing input to the IANA transition, and another work party looking at providing input to the current work going on with Jazz Global Advisors. I'll just briefly give you an idea of the sorts of reports that the SAC have produced in the last couple of years. There's been five reports produced on DNS security, from search list processing, DNS key rollover, looking an advisory on the mitigation of the name collision risk, a letter in response to ICANN board regarding interdisciplinary studies. It was a particular question posed to the SAC by the ICANN board, and an advisory on internal name certificates and the risk there posed by new GTLDs. In the category of DNS abuse, there was a report produced on distributed denial service attacks leveraging the DNS infrastructure. There's been a report produced on internationalized domain names, and two reports produced about registration data and the WHOIS system. So what I'd like to do, as I mentioned, rather than try to talk about all types of security attacks and security risks, which it's an evolving feast in many respects, I'd like to give you one example of a security attack. And this particular one is a distributed denial of service type attack. It is one that the SAC produced a report on last year, SAC 65. And I'd just like to give you a few more details on that. I'm sure all of you would have heard of a denial of service attack. That is one that attempts to make a machine or a network resource unavailable to users. A denial of service attack is one that is sent by one person or machine, and a distributed denial of service attack is one that is sent by more than one person or machine, a coordinated attack. So contemporary distributed denial of service attacks can actually use DNS reflection and amplification to actually achieve attack data bit rates in excess of 300 gigabits per second. The amount that what that means is, and I've got a diagram that will illustrate this, is that the attacker is trying to flood the network with queries and responses so that the network, and in particular a target victim, can no longer function at all. And underlying many of these types of attack is packet-level source address forgery or spoofing, where the attacker is actually pretending to be the victim. The attacker generates and transmits data packets purporting or pretending to be from that victim's IP address, and it uses the query response protocols, that is the very way that the DNS functions and is designed to function, to reflect and sometimes to amplify responses to achieve attack data transfer rates exceeding the victim's network capacity, so that effectively it shuts down the victim's ability to operate and many other victims as well. And the DNS, because of the fact that it operates on a query response type protocol, is especially suitable or indeed especially vulnerable for these types of attacks. So just a couple of explanatory terms for the diagram that I'm about to put up. It has some network devices in it named authoritative name servers, and what those are, it's a name server that actually gives the answers in response to questions asked about names in a zone. So if someone is trying to find a particular domain name or a particular website, if you like, they would send a query to an authoritative name server, and that name server would need to respond with the address of the domain name. An authoritative name server must, by definition, provide a response. A recursive name server or a caching name server is one that actually stores query results for a period of time. So it isn't by design an authoritative name server. It is one that is put in place by organisations to actually try and save time by having some frequently requested domain names more handy, if you like. So it is one that, if it doesn't have the answer to a query, it will refer the query on to an authoritative name server. So a recursive name server can be one of two types. It can be secure, where it will only respond to queries from authorized sources within its network, and that is a very good way to design recursive name servers that, for example, if a particular organisation puts in place a recursive name server, it ought to secure it by only permitting it to respond to queries from authorised machines within the network. An open recursive name server, however, simply responds to all queries irrespective of their source, and that is where some of the problems in distributed denial of service attacks come in. So looking at this diagram now, on the bottom you can see that we have the victim's machine represented, and at the top we have the attacker. And in the case on the left, where this is an example where an attacker is using open recursive DNS servers, the attacker is pretending to be at the IP address of the victim, that is, it's forging its IP address and sending a query to the open resolver saying, where is this domain name? That open resolver is then sending that query on to a number of authoritative name servers. The response is coming back, but the response is not going to the attacker because the attacker is pretending to have the IP address of the victim, so the victim is getting the response. And the more queries the attacker sends out, the more responses will go to the victim and eventually exceed their network. In the case on the right, we're talking about where the attacker is triggering a botnet. He has control of a botnet so that he's sending out one query, but the botnet is then sending or resending that query multiple times to authoritative name servers, and all of the responses again are going to the victim. So the victim basically gets shut down because their network capacity is exceeded. So the contributing factors to this is that critical basic controls for network access and DNS security haven't been widely implemented as is necessary to maintain and grow a resilient network. Basically, a lot of the name servers out there have not been secured, the recursive name servers. They have not been configured to only respond to authorized or to queries from authorized machines. And secondly, there are increasingly higher speed internet connections and growing power of individual end user devices, which results in an extraordinary and growing capacity for conducting very large scale and highly disruptive distributed denial of service attacks using these unsecured DNS name servers. So the higher, as our capacity on the internet increases, so does the capacity of these perpetrators to actually cause damage. So the recommendations that the ESAC proposed in this report after looking at this issue and explaining the contributing factors is that ICANN should help facilitate an internet-wide community effort to reduce the number of open resolvers and networks that allow this sort of network spoofing or imitation of victim devices, and that this effort should try to measure how frequently these open resolvers occur and to outreach to those organisations to try and get them to secure them. So in layman's term, to actually identify and publicise the scale of the problem and provide information to assist network operators both to understand why they need to secure their recursive name servers and to how they should go about doing that. Secondly, that all network operators should take immediate steps to prevent network address spoofing, and they can do that by actually actively checking where the queries that they are receiving are coming from and only responding to those from authorised machines. And this is something called network ingress filtering. Thirdly, that recursive DNS server operators should take immediate steps to secure any open recursive DNS servers and again make sure that they only respond to the queries from authorised sources. Fourthly, that authoritative DNS server operators, that is the name servers that must respond to every query, should support efforts to investigate authoritative response rate limiting. Some vendors of server equipment actually have software that enables the number of responses that can be transmitted to be limited within a particular time period, and what that does is if there is a DDoS attack that even if the number of queries exceeds a certain amount, the authoritative server will not respond to queries above a particular rate, and thereby the network capacity does not become exceeded. Fifthly, DNS server operators should put in place operational processes to ensure that their DNS software is regularly updated and to communicate with their software vendors to keep abreast of the latest developments. So it's like your virus checking software. There are always new threats arising, and if you are unable to keep your software up to date, you're not going to be able to combat any new threats. And similarly with DNS servers, unless the software is upgradable in the field to be able to deal with new types of threats, then the DDoS attack will be successful. And finally, manufacturers or people who configure customer premise networking equipment, that's the terminology for equipment that companies have within their organizations to actually maintain their own networking and their own computer systems, those manufacturers should take immediate steps to secure those devices and ensure that they are able to be upgraded in the field when new software is available to fix any security vulnerabilities, and to aggressively replace any equipment installed that cannot be upgraded. So basically, in colloquial terms, make sure customer network equipment doesn't respond to unauthorized queries. Make sure that all the equipment has software that can be upgraded, and replace any equipment that can't be. So that's the particular security issue in some depth. Obviously, there are quite a number of other security issues that from time to time will manifest themselves. But I guess to just reinforce that ICANN's role in maintaining the security and stability of the unique identifier system, the naming and addressing system, is one of its most important functions. That protects everybody operating on the internet, not just the internet service providers, but businesses, governments, all the way down to the end user. So that completes my presentation, and I'll throw back to you, to Jani.
Thank you very much, Julie, for this presentation. First of all, I will open the floor for questions. Everything is clear for you? Julie was very clear. She addressed particularly one case of, yes, we have Alan Greenberg. Alan, please.
Yeah, not a question, just a comment. Early on in the slides, you gave a list of perceived bad things that ICANN is not responsible for. I guess it's worth pointing out, although perhaps it's obvious, that although we're not responsible for fixing those problems, to the extent that those malfeasant things or perceived bad things are facilitated by weaknesses in the DNS, we do have a role to play in that case. I hope you'll agree. I think you'll agree.
I think I'd try
the next slide. I think it's the next one.
Yeah. some of these points here, I think, Alan, you're absolutely correct, and that's trying to capture that on that second slide, what I can does. So, yes, and good to reinforce that point.
I mean, it struck me where you talked about cybercrime and cyber warfare, and to the extent that those are facilitated by DNS weaknesses, we do have a role to play to try to plug those weaknesses, although we're not responsible for the actual actions. Anyway, just wanted to clarify. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Julie, and thank you, Alan. Olivier Crépin-Leblanc.
Thank you very much, Tijani. It's Olivier Crépin-Leblanc. Question regarding the issues. How does the FSAC select the issues?
You're far away, Olivier. Olivier, you are far away.
I'm far away. Well, this is there's no difference. Ah, is that better?
Much better.
Now it's good. Now it's good, yeah.
Okay, thank you. Sorry, apologies for this. So the question was, how does FSAC select the issues that it deals with? And if the ALAC, or at-large community, had some concerns about something to do with security and the DNS, could it ask FSAC for advice?
The answer, Olivier, to that last part is definitely yes. The FSAC will respond to any parts of the SOACs within ICANN if they have a particular security question that they want looked into. Sometimes the board asks the FSAC to look into a particular issue. A lot of the topics that the FSAC look into are actually raised by FSAC members themselves, and then they're prioritised at the annual planning session, even though I must confess that sometimes other things arise throughout the year that might actually affect the priority of those. So it's a combination of both from without and within that the topics arise.
Okay. Thank you, Julie. Now, Carlos Raul. Carlos, please.
Yes, thank you very much. Julie, it's a wonderful presentation for the non-technical people, so I really like the presentation. But I have a question. Do you have can you give orders of magnitude of the problem with these servers, unsecured servers? Where are they? What is the number? How much does it cost to replace? Who do the owners of these servers respond to in the ecosystem? Regional registries, or who can convince them to go through this upgrade of security? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Carlos. And indeed, the part of the problem is that we don't have a real grasp on how many of these unsecured servers there are, and that is what is behind the first recommendation that the FSAC made in FSAC 065 to try and get some metrics on how many open resolvers there are out there. There really isn't a lot of information on that, and I guess how much it would cost is really very dependent on what the technology is in a particular server that you're talking about. So that is one of those almost unanswerable questions. But the difficulty is in convincing DNS operators that this really is something that they ought to spend both effort and dollars on when, to some extent, there is no direct benefit to them. It certainly makes them non-vulnerable to DDoS attacks, but does that actually prevent them earning money? Not necessarily. So part of the problem is actually convincing people to do what is the best thing for the user, when in fact it's going to come out of their hip pocket.
Thank you, Julie. Now we have Otunti, please. You might be muted. Star 7 to unmute. Are you able to speak? Otherwise, until we find the problem, the technical problem with Otunti, I will give the floor to Alberto Sato. Alberto, please.
This is Alberto Sato speaking. Thank you very much, Tijani. I understand the technical issue, and I think that those who need to be convinced that they are unsecured in their DNS should not really come from ICANN, but actually from other stakeholder, which is the local government. They are the ones who should make the appropriate laws for security in all of the information systems within their jurisdiction. Why is that so? Because all of the attacks committed, all of the vulnerabilities in the information system were not on the DNS, they were not on the Whois system, but actually people believe that this is so. We have talked to the final users, and people believe that vulnerability comes from the lack of the of ICANN involvement, and this is not so. I think that the Maastricht stakeholder model should
go ahead.
We apologize, we are not hearing the speaker correctly. And then the other parties should be involved in that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Julie?
Thank you, Alberto. I think it would be good if governments could legislate for something like this to happen, but some of this infrastructure doesn't necessarily come under the control of governments and might not even reside within the jurisdiction of a government to actually impact the citizens of the nation. So some of these attacks are actually global attacks. So I think if governments were able to legislate it, it might resolve some of the problem, but I don't think it would take it all away. But certainly appreciate your comments.
Thank you, Julie. Otunti, are you able to speak now? If you are not, please drop a line in the chat so that I understand the problem. And another question to the staff, is he on the bridge or on the Adobe Connect? I don't see.
Tijani, if I may, while that's being sorted, Maureen has kindly pointed out that Sunil Lal has asked a question in the chat. How can one become an ESSAC member? The ESSAC members, I think I mentioned, go through an interview process. I'm probably one of the least technical ESAC members. I was proposed to ESAC as the ALAC liaison, and the ESAC have a policy that whether someone is a liaison or not, they have to be accepted by the ESAC as a full member and participate as a full member of ESAC. So I had to go through the interview process, and as I'm sure many other liaisons, I have to participate fully in the activities of the ESAC. So the ESAC assess other mechanisms whereby people can become ESAC members is they may be suggested by another ESAC member as someone whose skills might fill a particular niche that the ESAC might be lacking, or they may indicate to the ESAC themselves that they would be interested in joining. The ESAC itself does have a policy of not becoming too large. So 40 at the moment is actually quite large for the size of the ESAC. So it's certainly a much more restricted process than becoming a member of the ALAC or some of the other constituencies.
Thank you, Julie. I have the question of Otunti. He said, in my region, there are issues of credit cards not being allowed for use on the internet. What could be the reasons? This is the first question. The second one is some equipment manufacturers are said to implant surveillance chip in equipment, and is ESAC concerned about this?
I think that these are certainly general security issues. The issue of credit cards being allowed for not being allowed for use on the internet, that sounds like I'm not quite sure whether he's suggesting that companies are not, or banks are not allowing credit cards for use, but I would assume that that's to protect the users from having their information stolen and used. And there are a number of ways that that can happen. But I'm just not quite sure what is behind the question there. With regard to the second part of the question, is I'm just trying to get back to the wording of it. They are implanting surveillance chips. That is not really a DNS issue. The ESAC is concerned with security issues associated with the naming and addressing system of the internet, and a surveillance chip implanted in equipment, I guess, while it's certainly an issue of concern, I'm not sure that it's a DNS issue as such. So the ESAC needs to contain its focus to issues that are within ICANN's remit and that are really associated with the DNS.
Thank you very much, Julie. I do understand what you say, and I confirm that those are not DNS security and stability issues. those are security issues in general, but that doesn't have anything to do with the DNS. I still have Olivier now. Olivier Crépin-Leblanc, please.
Thank you very much, Tijani. It's Olivier Crépin-Leblanc speaking, and I was just going to add something to the discussion regarding the credit card security and so on. It is true, of course, on the one hand, that the reliability of a domain name and the ability of this domain name to be stolen or misused is a big issue. And, of course, the implementation of DNSSEC, which requires certificates, et cetera, and which to stop the use of, by hackers of some ways to be able to provide you with the wrong website, although the domain name is absolutely correct. So some kind of interception that a hacker would do. When you use DNSSEC, this kind of interception cannot happen anymore. And so as a result, that does help with the security of transactions on the Internet, because you are aware at that point that you can get little pieces of software, by the way, which will tell you if the domain is signed or not. You will be more aware that the domain name is DNSSEC signed, and of course, when you do any transaction, the little key is on your browser that shows, or sometimes they show other types of IP, should show that the connection is secure. But it's true that SBAC doesn't deal with the credit card transaction.
Thank you, Olivier.
Thank you, Olivier. I should have thought to mention that myself, and I didn't. So thank you. That's a really terrific point to make.
And Olivier, please try to find a way to speak in the microphone, because you are as if you are very far. So we barely understand you. Any other questions? If there is not, I will thank very much Julie Hammer for her presentation and her patience to answer our questions. I will thank you all for attending this webinar. Please don't forget to fill in the evaluation sheet that you received together with the invitation, and those evaluation sheets will make us improve the process, improve the system, improve the capacity building program till we reach the best point. Thank you very much, and bye-bye.
Thank you for
all the interpreters, the staff, and everyone who worked with us on this program. Thank you, Julie.
Thank you all. Bye-bye.
The meeting has now been adjourned. Thank you, everyone, for joining today's webinar. Please remember to disconnect all remaining lines at this time.